The following podcast is a Super Network production with your hosts, Super Marcy.
The main character of Plug is dirty and disgusting, and there's a scene in this film and you see he's got his big mutton chops, he's wearing a hat, he's making these grunting sounds.
The terrible Australian, Bea Jamine.
Marcy, there's a scene for poor Barry McKenzie where French police shoot up an entire box of Foster's beer with machine guns.
It contains coarse and explicit language.
Absolutely nothing. There's nothing there. This is This is a hole of a movie.
Mature themes.
I knew it was going to be a documentary about sex, but I thought it would be more about love and relationships and stuff like that. I didn't realize it was going to be about venereal diseases.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
For more, please visit supermarcy.com and show your support at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Enjoy the show.
G'day everyone, this is Bea Jamine, aka The Terrible Aussie, and welcome back to the long-awaited 12th episode of the Ausbloke Cast, the podcast where my co-host Super Marcy and I take a deep dive into Australia's Ausbloitation movement from the very beginning right up until today. And with me, as always, is my fellow very Aussie co-host, the one, the only, Super Marcy. Hello, Marcy. How are you?
G'day. How's it going? I'm doing pretty well, thanks.
Indeed. Well, it's nice to bring the Ausbloke cast back after so long, because it has been over a year since we last dropped an episode.
It has been a little while, and I will blame schedules and health and blah blah blah, but moving forward we will be aiming to get back to doing the podcast once a month, because we have a lot to get through.
Indeed. But a lot has happened since the last time we recorded an episode, Marcy, not just like in our personal lives or our work lives or podcast lives and all that, but most people probably don't realize is that, I should have stated this before in the intro, is that this is an award-winning podcast now.
It is. And I am very honored and, humbled that this podcast has won an award.
Indeed. And for those out there who are not sure what we're talking about, earlier this year, an episode of the podcast won the first ever Jim Murphy Broadcast Award for Electronic Media. So, and that was, of course, given to us by the Australian Film Critics Association, which we are members of. So thank you so much for that award. It means so much to us that this little podcast on Ausbloitation is it a certified award-winning podcast, Marcy?
Yeah, it is. And yeah, just absolute biggest thank yous and appreciations. And yeah, it means a lot that this podcast, got recognized in the first place. And it's funny that our return episode kind of has to do with the episode that won the award, because we are joined by the same guest from that award-winning episode.
Indeed. And he is a man who has been on previous episodes of this show, and particularly our award-winning episode. And he is also the host of the podcast Fearless Pretender. And that, of course, is our good friend Sam Inglis. Hello, Sam, and welcome back to the award-winning Ausbloke cast.
Hi, welcome. Hi, nice to be back. And that is why that episode I was on won awards. Because I'm just such a smooth, reliable voice on this podcast. I never make stumbles. I'm sure I only hampered your case, but very pleased with that result anyway. It's great to be back. I always have fun. Mostly have fun doing this show, so you know.
Indeed.
We're in my year this year. We haven't quite reached you guys, but we're in 1981, the year I was born. Interesting.
Oh, definitely, for sure. And so all of the five films which we're going to be talking about for this episode all came out in 1981, and we also have quite a bit of a variety of a little bit of everything. So we have a horror, we have a thriller, we have a crime film, we have a sexploitation film, and we also have an action adventure film. So so this episode covers quite a number of different genres of film in terms of exploitation. I'm very excited to talk about these five very different films with the both of you.
I had seen one of these before, and I don't think I'd really heard of the others except one because that came with the Felicity Blu-ray.
Indeed, indeed. But for those out there who are not unaware what films we're going to be doing for this comeback episode of the Ozploycast, for this episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the films Hoodwink, Center Spread, Race for the Yankee Zephyr, Road Games, and Dead Kids, or as it's also known in other parts of the world as Strange Behavior. So we might as well get straight to it and talk about our very first film, which of course is the 1981 crime drama Hoodwink.
Who's in charge?
I am.
Can we go in there and talk?
What about?
Stop playing the big cop for a minute, will you?
We'll talk.
Lucy, too.
We do business? Depends.
You're only holding me for extradition to New South. I'm clean up here, right? What about Lucy?
A bus for harbouring you?
$2,000 to forget her.
Can't hear you.
Look, a clean bust on me and no charges against Lucy. $4,000. You can split it with the others.
Fair enough.
Uncuff me for a minute. Thanks, mate.
Oh, I keep the rest.
How much you got in your wallet?
About 1,200.
We'll bust you for it. Make it look good down at headquarters. Get dressed. Anything else you want? One minute.
Which was directed by Claude Wadham, written by Ken Quinnell, a story based on Carl Strudendahl, if I butchered your last name, please forgive me, And this film stars John Hargreaves, Judy Davis, Dennis Miller, no, not that Dennis Miller, Wendy Hughes, Max Cullen, Paul Schlubb, and Michael Caton. And the plot summary for this film, which is from IMDb, is a true story about a jailed bank robber who pretends he's become blind to get an early release. Cops don't believe him, but a lonely minister's wife arrives to teach him how to live with his condition. They fall in love. Big mistake. Now, Marcy, since this is our comeback episode of the show, would you like to be the first one up and tell us your thoughts on Hoodwink?
Absolutely, absolutely. Hoodwink is a strange one. The genre of film and tone changes unexpectedly from set piece to set piece. This is something that can work in a film. Here, it just feels quite disjointed and it doesn't know what it wants to be or what it wants to say. However, after watching the film, I read about some behind the scenes of what happened, and that made a lot of sense as to why the film turned out the way that it did. So for the positives, John Hargreaves does give a great performance as main character Martin. The charisma certainly helped make this not likable character easier to be around. Also, Judy Davis as Lucy, who is the minister's wife, is good, despite not really being given much to work with. There are some fun moments, more so during the first act of the film. And I guess I can't complain that Hargraves is shirtless, almost naked, and naked for a bunch of the film. And for the not so positives, again, tonally, it's a mess. And the first part of the film is a silly crime caper. And then it becomes a prison film with a different tone. And the main character pretends to be blind in order to help his cause get out of jail and whatnot. Then it becomes a melodrama with a quick and not convincing romance. I feel there was potential for the film to be fun, but it kind of leaves that behind. Then you have the character faking having a disability. Those around him treat him differently and poorly, partially because they don't actually believe him. And there could have been a lot said about how disabled people are treated, but there isn't. Then at the end, Martin doesn't seem to have learned anything, and he's just back to his old shitty ways as he escapes prison once again. And I haven't even mentioned that the characters of Lucy and Ralph, who is the minister, they've taken in Martin to help him because he's blind, but then find out almost straight away Martin is faking being blind and just allow him to continue. For me, it's a real example of a mixed bag film.
Mm-hmm. And Seb, your thoughts on Hoodwink?
Yeah, I mean, to jump off some of what Marcy was saying, I think, as far as I can tell, it's relatively loosely based on Carl Cynodal, I think is his name. I've got to say, I'm incidentally quite glad that they changed the name of the main character to Martin Stang. Because given that the way they've written it, he gets to go out for Sunday afternoons with a pastor and his wife, it just makes the real name of the guy feel a little on the nose. It's his real name. I think if you put it in this film, you might go, that's a little preachy, almost. And it's like, from my research, which, you know, is just a couple of articles, you know, I didn't have time to do a massive deep dive, but it does seem that it sort of combines a couple of things that actually happened to Carl, but they're distinct from each other in real life. So the main story of his pretending to be blind to get an easier ride in prison is true. He did get out on day visits and fall for somebody, breaking up that family. And he did meet somebody who worked in the prison, a doctor who later became his wife. But all of those things were separate. But beyond whether it's true or not, it's well enough told. I agree with Marcy. I think the first half is probably more fun. You get a sense of Martin's life on the run, going between scores and between women. There's one played by Wendy Hughes, who seems to be a long-term partner, while Kim Deacon's character is a woman he picks up in a bar. And then prison life is a little different, and we see him falling for Judy Davis. And as you were saying, I don't think it's a great part for Judy Davis, but I do think she's very, very good in it. I mean, Judy Davis is who she is. You know, there's not much to argue with in many of her performances. You know, she's just a terrific actress. But despite that, she can't, and nor can Hargreaves, really make the idea that Martin and Sarah are in love really play. She's particularly good though in the moment that she shares that her husband hasn't touched her since their youngest child was born, and there's a sort of post-coital scene with Martin that she's also very good in and feels very intimate, despite the fact that weirdly it's the only such scene in the film that doesn't feature any nudity. So, which contributes to kind of the second half feels a bit more televisual, like a movie of the week kind of thing. But, you know, despite the fact that it's short and underdeveloped part, it still won her Best Supporting Actress from the AFI that year. So, you know, you can't really argue with it. There's a lot of other stuff to get into, but, you know, I'll sort of, that's kind of my general take on it.
Well, I guess for my thoughts on Hoodwink, like, the only thing I kind of knew when I sat down to watch this film was that it was an early role for for Judy Davis. This was like one of her first big major parts after My Brilliant Career, which was the film that kind of catapulted her internationally. And
My Brilliant Career is an exploitation film, by the way, but it's a fucking masterpiece and everyone listening should see it.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And also, like, I knew it was a crime story, but that was kind of the only real things I kind of knew about this film going into it. So when you have the first half with John Hargreaves just going around doing all these different kind of robberies and heists, and also all betting all these different women, like, I thought, okay, this is where the fun kind of exploitation vibe is kicking in. But once he kind of gets arrested and then is sent off to jail, and then he kind of hatches the idea to pretend he is blind so he can at least get a lesser prison sentence, that's where the movie kind of changes gears. Like he's both said, he does switch tones and becomes a completely different film. Like, it does become more of a straightforward drama. And then when it gets to his relationship with Judy Davis's character, I do agree that that whole romance did feel very rushed. Like, you could have easily expanded that entire section into its own film. It would have made it a much more compelling and more well-rounded romance. So, yeah, I agree with both of you that this film, on a tonal level, is very uneven. However, I think what makes the film work overall for me are the performances from the cast, particularly John Hargreaves, who we have talked about a lot on past episodes of the show, Marcy.
We have indeed, yes.
And he is great in this film. And also all the other characters who were sprinkled throughout, they all deliver pretty solid turns. And yeah, on paper, Judy Davis's role is definitely underwritten, but given how great of an actress she is, she brings so much emotional depth to that character. And you can buy who she is as a person and why she kind of is very struck by John Hargreaves' character. But one thing I sort of noticed a lot throughout this film is, like, there's a couple of actors who we've seen before in other films, like Dennis Miller and Michael Caton, who, of course, one of the last time the three of us got together to talk about exploitation, we talked about the film The Last of the Knuckleman, which they both appeared in.
Yes.
But also, this film, to my shock, also marked the film debuts of both Jeffrey Rush and Colin Friels, who is also Judy Davis's husband in real life. So that was kind of a surprise to me because I was not expecting them to be in the movie. And of course, Marcy, you and I had to talk about this, that Alf, a.k.a. Raminger from Home and Away, is in this movie.
Yes, and there's actually another character who looks like Alf in, you know, 90s Home and Away. So it was kind of funny, and it's like, that's not Alf, but it looks like Alf. And then literally the next scene, oh, there is Alf, but they look like the same person in different life stages.
Definitely, definitely. So I do agree overall it is a mixed bag of a film. That, like I said, I think it's really more sort of the tonal shifts and also some aspects of the story could have been developed more. But I think it's still a pretty interesting little film. And I think what made it at least pretty engaging for me as a viewer is, of course, the performances of the cast. And also, John Hargreaves in particular is just fantastic in this film.
You know who doesn't agree with you about that?
The real life person that the character is based on?
yeah, he's not pleased. He doesn't like this movie. His summation apparently is that it was a shit movie. I don't agree with him, but... And his problem with Hargreaves isn't so much that he thinks he's bad in the film, but Hargreaves is 6'2", and Carl Sindel thought he was just too tall to play him, saying that it didn't show a small guy who had enough backing to get himself through. And I agree with you guys, though, that he's excellent in the part. He's got this sort of convincing, lovable rogue thing that carries you through a lot of other stuff that, even though it's a true story, somewhat might be implausible in the hands of another actor. So, you know, I think there's some good stuff going on there. I think some of Cynodal's other criticisms are a bit more on the money, you know. He says that Claude Wortham, who's an English director, had no knowledge of the Australian way of life or idiom, and all he wanted to do was have naked women in front of the camera. That's borne out by the first half of the film. It is really very exploity in that there's a lot of mainly natural nudity, the kind that you would today hide with L-shaped sheets or, you know, characters lounging around in their underwear after sex. It does feel more realistic, but it is also fairly exploitative. So, and given that Cynodal says he didn't even want any sex in the movie, you know, it's I can see why he has an issue with some of that.
I could definitely see that too, but I think at the end of the day, since this is a film that's more partially based on his life more than anything, I guess that gives the filmmakers more artistic license to kind of add a few other elements to it to kind of not make it like, I honestly didn't realize that this film was based on a true story until after I finished watching it and did my own kind of research into it. So, but I should have suspected that while watching the film, but I thought it's such an outlandish this kind of premise, it couldn't possibly be true. But I think at the end of the day, like, I could definitely see his criticisms. That being said, though, like I said, I think given that this is only partially based on his life, the kind of the changes that they made, or at least kind of to make it more cinematic, didn't really bother me too much, though. So, but that's just me personally.
Yeah, no, certainly. And I think once you change the name, you lose some of the obligation to the real guy to a certain degree.
Definitely. And also, like, just looking like at this film was also a early cinematography gig for Dean Sebler, who would actually go on to win an Oscar 9 years later for Dances with Wolves. So this was one of his earliest kind of films that he shot. And, you know, he would go on to be a major cinematographer down the line, both here and in Hollywood as well. But like you, I do agree at the same time, though, with you, Sam, it does, especially the last half, have kind of a TV feel to it in that second half.
Oh, yeah, it definitely does. Like, the way the film shifts, it's very noticeable. It is very noticeably different because that first section does have that, you know, exploitation feel in it. And then it does feel like just part of a TV drama. And it doesn't quite work in that way. And it really sticks out a lot. And, you know, at least for me, I couldn't work out what this film wanted to be. And, you know, as you've both talked about with the behind the scenes and it being, you know, loosely based on somebody's life, like, these things make sense into why it's the way it was, which I said earlier, because again, I watched the film and then read up about it, because I like to kind of, if I haven't seen the film, go into it just without knowing and then make the judgments. But yeah, it was a bit of a strange one.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say in our notes here that apparently four Australian directors turned this down and a couple of them worked on the screenplay, because for me, it almost feels like the two halves were directed by two different guys. And that's why it never quite comes together the way you want it to. It sort of feels confused. So, but you had some more details on that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And also the fact that there was a bit of controversy about the hiring of the director in the film, because at the time when Claude Wortham was, of course, being a British filmmaker coming to Australia to make this film, there was controversy because a lot of Australian filmmakers felt that this film, or any Australian film, should be made by Australian filmmakers, because this year in particular, because you had this film, and then, of course, one of the other films we're going to be talking about later, Race for the Yankee Zephyr, and also another film we're going to be talking about in a future episode, The Survivor, which were both directed by British actor David Hemmings got a lot of Australian filmmakers up at arms. So then, of course, like a lot of Australian filmmakers decided to create a union. So the filmmakers banded together and formed a new body called the Australian Feature Film Directors Association, or the AFDA, to kind of combat that, and so that any Australian projects would be directed by Australian filmmakers. So it's kind of interesting how this film and also two others that came out the same year actually caused quite the controversy and kind of changed the landscape of Australian cinema after that, to make sure that Australian films are directed by Australian filmmakers.
Yeah. And it's interesting that what's interesting about that is, you know, forming in these unions and stuff, that some of those directors who, you know, weren't happy about it had actually turned down offers to direct the film. Bede, who were the four film directors that turned down working on the film?
Well, one of the directors is someone we've talked about a couple of times on this show, Marcy, and that, of course, is Bruce Beresford. He was offered to direct this film, and then he turned it down. And then, of course, there was Michael Thornhill, then Philip Noyce, and then Espen Storm. But the last two directors, Philip Noyce and Espen Storm, as you said before, Sam, actually did work on this film enough that they would actually work on the screenplays for it. But interesting enough, though, when they organized this union, it was actually Philip Noyce who was one of the ones who really campaigned for this union to be organized and against this film as well. So it's kind of funny to me how I could definitely understand of wanting an Australian filmmaker to work on Australian film, but when you have that many Australian directors turning the project down or just walking away from it, I mean, it doesn't, I can definitely see why the production company would have to look outside of Australia to see if anyone was interested to direct the film. Not that I approve of it, but I can understand why they would do that.
So just to give some context on Claude Wortham, because, you know, I think he's come in for a bit of a kicking here. I don't know a lot of his work, in that I haven't seen a lot of his work, but a lot of it is pretty notable. He did a lot of TV plays, things like, The Wednesday Play and Play for Today, which were, you know, well-regarded series of TV plays in the UK. This is all pretty much in the UK. He worked on an episode of the celebrated miniseries Elizabeth R., did the TV film of Cider with Rosie, shot Swallows and Amazons, and finished up in 1991 with a film called Buddy's Song, which is most famous. I don't know if this was a hit in Australia, for Chesney Hawke's hit, I Am the One and Only. That is something I suspect for the British audience.
Definitely. But I think it's interesting, though, because, again, like, I wasn't aware that he was British until, again, after doing my research on the film after I watched it. Like, I just assumed, oh, it's just an Australian director making the film. Like, I guess it just didn't really bother me that much, given who directed the film at the end, because, again, I just assumed he was an Australian filmmaker.
Well, if Cinedol's criticism is that Wortham didn't understand the Australian idiom, is that something that you guys felt in the film? Because obviously I have no reference point for that.
I felt it. Like I said, I just assume it felt like a very Australian film to me.
Yeah, there wasn't anything in particular that, you know, would suggest to me that it was missing something with an Australian feel. I didn't pick up on any of that.
Just wondered, coming at it from, you know, British perspective.
Yeah, exactly.
But I guess that could be a wrap on this discussion of Hoodwink. And Marcy, your final thoughts and rating for the film?
Yeah, I give this one 3 constantly shirtless John Hargreaves out of 5. Yes, the film has some issues, as we've discussed, but it was still fine to to watch it and then find out about all the stuff afterwards. But yeah, it's an interesting little experiment that doesn't quite hit the landing or quite always work, but there's definitely things to appreciate about it.
And Sam, your final thoughts and rating for the film?
Yeah, I mean, because it's so tonally confused, it does kind of end up feeling like two movies that somebody's jammed together, as I said, and maybe even two movies that have been directed or certainly controlled by two different people. I mean, I don't know how accurate any of that is, but it's weirdly dissonant at times. So that would be like a two or a two and a half, except that Hargreaves and Judy Davis are so damn good in the film that I ended up going for a 3-star grade on this one.
And Pete?
You know what? I'm kind of in agreement with the both of you. I'm going to give this 3 out of 5 as well. Yeah, like I said, it is a very tonally uneven film. Maybe not totally jarring, but it definitely is still quite uneven. But I think it's still a pretty watchable film, and I still found that the story pretty compelling for what it is. And but for me, at the end of the day, what made the film work overall was the performances from the cast, particularly from John Hargreaves and Judy Davis in particular. I think their performances are definitely one of the strongest aspects of the film. And we'll move right along to our second film, which, of course, is the 1981 sci-fi sexploitation film Center Spread.
This is the future. Gerard is the photographer who must find and shoot the ultimate center spread.
Just what are you looking for? I've seen lots of girls through here who look terrific.
That's just the problem. They all look alike. We've seen them all before. What we're looking for is someone different, fresh, a new look. The problem is we don't know what to look for. And to top it all, we're running out of time.
Where do I come in?
Right here. We want you to find her.
Wanted something different, something for the new century.
No! No!
And Gerard had to find her. Center spread. Center spread. Watch all your dreams come true.
This film was directed by Tony Patterson, written by Michael Ralph and Robert Fogden. It stars Kylie Foster, Paul Trahair, Mark Watson, Ivor Lewis, and Jack Needle. And the plot summary for this one from IMDb is, and the plot summary, which I'm reading off IMDb, is the story of a photographer's struggle in the glamorous world of nude modeling. Now, Marcy, can tell us your thoughts on Center Spread.
How do you make boobs and nudity boring? Center Spread is how. I don't recall ever being this bored with nudity in a film. And I've sat through quite a lot of sexploitation films with this podcast alone. I don't know what this film wanted to say, if anything at all. It really is an excuse to show nudity. and it's boring. The whole setting could be interesting, that it's, you know, set in the future under a harsh rule in society, but they don't do anything with it. And it's all we really know is that in this society, if you pretty much do as you're told, you get treated better. So you get, you know, more things than everybody else. But also, photographs in magazines have something to do with it. It isn't at all explained. And the visuals do not tell a story besides, oh, look, more tits. The sound for this film gets repetitive so quickly. It starts to grate on the ears so fast. And just when you thought they were done, that same score hits again. Yeah, the positives I could give the film. The first two strange photo shoots are a decent setup. Even if their uniqueness doesn't show up again, I don't think anything is as striking visually as those two. Nikki is a character played by Kylie Foster, who has just the right look for the it girl that the photographer Gerard is tasked to find. And her photos are perhaps the best visuals in the film, or at least maybe the most memorable. This one wasn't camp enough to be fun. It wasn't interesting enough to really do anything. There could have been an interesting story, but I don't think anyone bothered to try.
Alrighty. And Sam, your thoughts on Center Spread?
Okay, so that IMDb plot summary is bare bones to the point of uselessness. And Marcy went into a few more details, but let me try and pick through what this pile of shit, spoilers, is actually about. So it appears to be about a post-apocalyptic society where some kind of computer-driven overlord has taken over, tasked one man to take nude photos for one of a series of populist controlling magazines. Pinky in the Brain?
Same thing we do every night, Pinky. Try to take over the world.
Fucking what? It is hilariously pretentious and shitty. It appears through the hazy print and sound that appears to have been recorded with a mic 6 feet out and outside a nearly soundproof room to have the plot that I just outlined. And, you know, it's hard to tell because, as I said, I could barely hear it. I think that's more to do with the print than the original recording. If you said this is on the Blu-ray for Felicity in Australia?
Yes.
Yeah. I didn't have the comparative luxury of that. I watched a VHS rip on the Internet Archive. So maybe it sounded better for you guys and you had the misfortune of understanding more of the dialogue. I think these filmmakers want us to imagine, or would love us to imagine, that they anticipated the likes of Videodrome, Brazil, or The Matrix on a budget of 47p. But actually, it's kind of closer to the more recent and legendarily nonsensical After Last Season. And if you haven't seen that, you know, look it up on YouTube and maybe watch a video about it rather than actually watching the film, because Jesus Christ. But instead of After Last Season, which cuts randomly to computer animation of simple shapes, this cuts to tits. It probably has more nudity per minute of screen time than any non-porn movie I've seen, and probably some porn movies, to be honest. For roughly every 3 to 5 minutes, less, in fact, in the first half of the film, that there is of anything else in this movie, it will cut to 2 minutes of a selection of women modeling nude. Now, to be clear, when I was 13, I would have worshipped at the feet of this movie. You know, I got into exploitation films and foreign films more generally, if I'm honest, because it was a great way to see beautiful women quite often without their clothes on. And, you know, that's no bad thing even now. But 30 years later, I do need a little bit more than that to hold my attention. And this, the nudity in this is grindingly pointless and tedious. And I actually just wanted to fast forward through rather than to those bits, despite the fact that the women are often spectacularly good looking. We can talk more about the sort of ins and outs of what happens and the performances in a bit, but I think, you know, we should invite Bede to share his apparently different thoughts, and I'm fucking baffled.
As am I, so I'm looking forward to this.
Well, I should say it off beforehand, Marcy. We have done this show for about, well, now 12 episodes, and you already know my feelings on a lot of sexploitation films. Like, we've talked about, like, Felicity, which I was not a fan of at all. But I'm also somebody who has never liked any of the Emmanuel films or the Story of O films, because I just find all those films completely boring on both on a story front, on a sensual front. They just did not work for me at all. And so I was expecting to pretty much be the same when it came to Censor Spread, especially that it also was paired with Felicity on the Blu-ray here in Australia. But to my surprise, I actually did not mind it. I don't know what it is about this film. It had me transfixed from beginning to end. And of course, everyone's probably going to think, oh, it's the boobs. No, believe me, it was not. It wasn't the boobs.
It was the boobs.
It was not the boobs.
I mean, it was probably the boobs. They're nice boobs. Don't get me wrong.
I mean, they are nice boobs, but that's not what transfixed me about the film. But
okay.
But I think it was really kind of the vibe it had. And the fact that, like, as it goes on, you find that, oh, this is more of a sci-fi film rather than that's in this kind of dystopian world. And I thought, okay, that's interesting. Like, I do agree with how it could have dived into more of sort of the societal aspects of the story, because it's kind of more vague or just hints at certain things. But I don't think that the film is saying, like, all of this is on the hinges of one photographer. From the what I gathered from the film is, like, there's multiple different photographers in different sectors to do this magazine. But I think that's kind of the thing that I found interesting about the film is the vagueness of its lack of its story and also its themes. Like, there's definitely a lot of tits and ass in this film. Let's not get around that. And, like, the women in this film are spectacular looking. I'm not going to disagree with that. And I do feel like the film does focus way too much on that, especially with the photography scenes, which I will admit are, compared to other ones we have covered on this very show, there's a very artistic quality to those scenes that I found quite unique in how they were sort of presented. But also, I think, too, again, the vibe of it I found interesting. It just had this different vibe compared to other sexploitation films that we have covered on this show. And also visually, I think it's one of the more impressive ones that we have done as well, because I think the cinematography by Jeffrey Simpson is a highlight for sure. This was his first cinematography gig. And after this, he would go on to shoot other classic films like Shine, The Navigator, A Medieval Odyssey, and so many others. Like, he has got, like, a major stack of films he would shoot after this. And I gotta say, like, oh, and he would also work with Gillian Armstrong on a few films, including her version of Little Women as well. But
just to be clear, I'm not going to talk shit on the cinematography, because I, like I said, saw a VHS rip that was like watching it through a tea bag. So,
yeah,
you know, I would suggest that I don't really know what the cinematography looks like, because I didn't see it in any kind of condition to judge that. So
that's fair. That's fair. But I guess I just found it more interesting. Like, yes, it doesn't entirely successfully work in what it's trying to do or trying to say, but I just found it interesting. But also, it for me, what I find even more interesting is the sort of the character stuff, because you have the main character of
Gerard.
Gerard, yes. The character of Gerard, which I will admit the acting is not the best in this film.
No.
But I found his character interesting because he is a character who, like, even though he's photographing boobs on a daily basis, he seems to be very delusioned by this whole job that he's doing, to the point where it almost feels manufactured. There's no personality, no or anything, until he meets our main female character, played by Kylie Foster, which is which is the character of Nikki, and it kind of sparks something in him, and he kind of sees her as inspiration for some creative drive that he hasn't in a long time. And even though he wants to shoot her for photos, he kind of realizes that, you know, there's a purity to her that he kind of doesn't want to put out there into the world and destroy it, so that it's part of this magazine world of which this film is centered in. I know I'm not describing this the best I can, but I find it just interesting that in a way the film kind of looks at, I guess, the creative process, and when you feel like you're in a job where you have no passion, it feels manufactured, it feels phoned in, but you find someone or something that strikes something in you that, you know, you get that drive once again. I know this is like a weird thing that I picked up from this film, but I got that from this film, but I was like, oh,
I don't think the story point of man who photographs tits all the time gets bored of photographing tits is particularly revelatory, first of all.
Well, I can understand that, but that's kind of the feeling I got from the film and what I think is interesting.
If I can interject as well, the what he's doing is basically manufactured. Like, he's being told what to do, so he's just doing what he's doing. You get the feeling like it's not so much about inspiration. He just seems to go with it, and he doesn't have any real emotion either way. So I didn't really pick up on any of that other than, you know, he's being told what to do, so he's doing it, and they're, you know, not that happy with it. So he's like, okay, I got to find the next it girl. And that just goes in a way that the rest of the film doesn't even, like, you wouldn't think it was going to go there. And I don't know if it really makes sense. I was not a fan of this film after the first two photography scenes. Every time another one came up, it was just felt so repetitive. And it really got to the point where I didn't really care about Nikki and Gerard, and there was no chemistry between the characters and them being in love, like, straight away. Again, it's what was an issue with the previous film. That just really doesn't work. It's not convincing, but anyway.
There's also this very little sense of world building, because, you know, they clearly didn't have a budget for it. So we don't really know what the authority that's controlling Gerard is. Mm. It never establishes the parameters of this dystopian world. Like when Nikki and Gerard first meet, and she wants to touch his car because she can't believe that he actually owns one. But then she goes off in a huff when he's lost his keys and can't drive her anywhere. Don't worry, a randomly angry old man returns the keys 4 seconds later. If you're invested in that, you're not. But it's just one of many scenes that are like, okay, I guess that could be interesting if you'd established anything about the world before you did that scene, but you haven't. At that point, I don't even know that we really understand that it is this dystopia. This is the first scene, I think, really outside of Gerard's studio, where, you know, we just get numbing series of photographic setups. which really have almost no time in between them in the first half hour of the film. I mean, with the best will in the world, if the script were better, maybe Paul Traher and Kylie Foster would be better in it. But I've got to say, I'm not shocked that neither of them went on to particularly glittering careers. Kylie Foster is gorgeous, but she doesn't have anything to work with to create a character here. So I don't know if she's a good actress. Traher, the same goes for him. So, you know, it's not their fault that neither of them are any good in the film. But, you know, when they have no motivation and no screenplay backing them up, how could they be? The love story, of course, is deeply unconvincing. And so it's just completely inconsequential when the authority splits them up. And again, 30 seconds of screen time later, you know, we get the sort of coda of the ending. I can see what Bede's talking about in the concept of what the film is trying to say, but it has none of the tools to say any of it acting and play.
But I would argue, yeah, but I guess I can understand that, but I think it's the vagueness that I think was alluring to me as a viewer. Like, I'm sort of filling in the gaps myself rather than having everything kind of spelt out for me. Like I said, it's the mixture of the sort of vague world building, but also just the tone and vibe of it that just, I'm not going to use the word surreal because it's not a surreal film at all, but it has the feel of one, even if it's not one, if that makes any sense whatsoever.
It kind of starts off with a bit of a surrealist thing going on, but it's kind of abandoned again after the two more interesting and unique photo shoots. Like, I do see where you're coming from with how you felt. It's just I did not feel that way.
Indeed.
So, are we going to wrap up on this one?
Yes, we might as well. Now, before we get to our final thoughts and rating on the film, I'll go over some trivia on the film. The film was actually shot on 60mm film stock and then blown up to 35mm for the printed release format. And on its Wikipedia page, it actually goes into that in much more in-depth, which is actually pretty interesting if you want to know on how... Yeah, because I believe it was one of the earliest Australian films to actually do that. And which was a benefit for a lot of Australian filmmakers if they weren't able to afford 35mm stocks. So they were able to do it this way. And also, in the UK, the British Board of Film Classification ordered cuts totaling 2 minutes and 10 seconds in order for the film to secure an 18 rating. The BBFC website states, this work is cut. To obtain this category, cuts 2 minutes and 10 seconds were required. This UK version of Set of Spread is now available on the Australian Blu-ray release. Because I do remember if you go in the special features version that is here in Australia, it does actually have the UK version of the film. So with that out of the way, Marcy, your final thoughts and rating for this movie?
I give this film 1, I am getting bored of looking at tits, out of 5. This film, I guess on paper, this film looks like it would be something that I would like and get something out of, but I didn't. I don't even know if I could recommend this film. It's if you don't mind just being bored looking at nudity, go for gold, I guess.
And Sam, your final thoughts and rating for the film?
So yeah, I imagine that there is some YouTuber out there, or Bede when he becomes a YouTuber.
I'm already a YouTuber.
Oh, sorry, bro.
Are you about to offend me, Sam? Just saying.
Oh, yeah, probably, but I'll start that again. So I imagine there is some YouTuber out there, or, you know, Bede, who will get on a video and try and claim this as some sort of visionary, slightly surreal masterpiece. They're wrong. It's not that. It's an inept and boring nudity delivery system, and frankly, it's the kind of film that stopped needing to exist the second that you got broadband. So no fucking stars, fuck you.
Well, I'm just gonna say this. If you both, now, I'm just gonna, before I get to my final thoughts and rating, I'm just gonna say these things: Badass Bunyip, Freddy's Fridays, Amityville Thanksgiving, The Beasts of Yucca Flats, Witchmas, Doom Asylum, Detective Knight, Independence, Out of Death, The Reliant, Ghosts Can't Do It, The War with Grandpa, A Wrestling Christmas Miracle, Home Sweet Home, A Madea Family Funeral, Nemesis 2, Nebula, Bloody Murder, Mr. Jingles, Battleground Melbourne, Veronica, Lawnmower Man 2, Beyond Cyberspace. Now,
naming other bad films doesn't disprove that a different film is bad.
Well, here's the thing, Sam. Those films that I mentioned are way worse than this one. And the reason, and going into my final thoughts and rating for this film, I'll actually go into my final thoughts first. Compared to all those films, this one, at least for me, was interesting. I didn't find it boring. I found it strangely hypnotic as a film. And no, it wasn't because of the boobs. I'm putting it out there right now. If anything, that was kind of the thing that least I was entranced by. But I found the vagueness of the story interesting. I found that there is some thematic elements that, for me, I found quite interesting. And also visually, I think compared to other sexploitation films that we have covered on this show, it is far more visually vibrant and striking compared to others. And compared to other sort of narrative-driven sexploitation films that we have covered on this show so far, this one is definitely, without a doubt, the most interesting one that we have done. Is it a good movie per se? No, because it does have its flaws. But out of all the ones that I have covered for this show, it's definitely, without a doubt, the most intriguing and unique one we've covered. So my rating for this film is 2.5 out of 5. And yes, I'll be doing a video on YouTube about this and telling.
But anyway, it's a masterpiece. You've got to make your video now.
Exactly. But moving right along to our next film, which of course is the 1981 action adventure film Race for the Yankee Zephyr.
Look at this! Oh, damn! There's about 1,000 more down there just like that.
Yankee Zephyr!
The race is on for a fortune in gold. And the competition is killing.
What if I told you to get your zoo back in their basic black Land Cruisers and piss off on my property before I lose my patience?
It's just that I don't think that thing is very safe. Do you think I'm supposed to be impressed by that kind of flying? I am not! I want to be put down. I want to be put down! Oh! A couple of hours, you said it would take. Just fly up the old Beetlebopter. Piece of pudding.
Jesus, you get the wind up if every little thing doesn't run like clockwork.
You see, the first time I saw the Yankee Zephyr, I was suspended arse over elbow underneath a Mixmaster.
That can be arranged.
Let me go!
Now, Mr. Gibson, I neglected to introduce my associates. This is Mr. Broken Teeth. This is Mr. Ruptured Spleen.
Join the race for the Yankee Zephyr in the chase to end all chases.
Which was directed by David Hemmings, written by Everett DeRoach, who is a name we have talked about quite a lot on this show in the past, Marcy. And this film stars Ken Wall, Leslie Ann Warren, Donald Pleasance, George Pepper, and Bruce Lawrence. And the plot summary for this one, which I am reading off IMDb, is a drunken deer hunter, his pilot colleague, and his daughter compete with a villainous treasure hunter to reach a lake nestled among the mountains of New Zealand when a World War II era plane wreck carrying a fortune in gold is submerged. Now, Marcy, tell us your thoughts on Race for the Yankee Zephyr.
Yeah, so this was a film about how drunk Donald Pleasance could get, or was it a competition for who could camp it up more with Pleasance and George Peppard? I mean, this is an odd one, but there is a bit of fun to it as well. I mean, within the first 10 minutes, Donald Pleasance is hanging out of a helicopter. It adds in some quirky villains and a treasure hunt. It's totally silly for sure. The stunts are absolutely insane, but somehow for me, it just doesn't quite come together as a whole. It felt like there was just something missing. Maybe the stakes weren't really there. And, you know, besides the characters that Pleasance and Peppard play, the rest aren't all that memorable. I felt like I had a good time watching the film. Don't get me wrong. I just don't think it lived up to the potential.
And Sam, your thoughts on Race for the Yankee Zephyr?
I mean, far be it from me coming from a different culture to tell you what falls into, you know, specifically Australian cultural bubbles. But from what I've seen, this doesn't feel like much of an exploitation movie to me. There's a little bit of swearing. There's quite a lot of guns. And one see-through shot of Leslie Ann Warren, which kind of comes out of nowhere. But it's much more like just a pure adventure movie to me. It doesn't feel like a real exploitation film in that sense. And honestly, with just a few cuts to de-emphasize Donald Pleasance's character's alcoholism and the guns, this could probably be like a Magical World of Disney film. You know, put a 12-year-old in it, you know, sub Leslie Ann Warren out with a kid for Ken Wall's character. And, you know, this is just a solid little kid venture movie, you know? But I enjoyed it for what it was, which really is a stunt show more than it is a particularly engaging narrative film. A hilariously obvious stunt show at sometimes, but, you know, I think Marcy's right. Pleasance is the most interesting and most entertaining thing here, and yeah, he gives good drunkard. I didn't so much enjoy George Peppard, the sort of effete English villain and his henchman. I found really rather unmemorable. But yeah, just watching this as like a stunt reel, I had fun with it.
Well, I've seen this movie twice now, and I will say this though, I do agree with both of you. I think it's a pretty solid adventure film, but it definitely doesn't quite live up to the potential it could have had. Like, they could have done more with the story, and it is kind of feels very out of Everett DeRoach's wheelhouse compared to the other films that he has written in the past we've talked about on this show, like Patrick, Harlequin, Snapshot, and Long Weekend. You know, those totally feel very different compared to this one, which you could definitely tell he wanted to write this sort of big, bombastic adventure film. And having David Hemmings, British actor David Hemmings, coming in to direct the film. And mind you, at this point, like, David Hemmings seems to be getting all in on the exploitation genre, because we've talked about him a few times on the show since he starred in both First and Harlequin. And he's directing an Australian-New Zealand co-production here. But I was actually pretty surprised with how he handled the film filmmaking wise, but I do agree with you, Sam. I think one of the big highlights of this film is all the major action and stunt set pieces. All of them are pretty insane, especially the jet boat sequence that we see later on in the sort of the last half of the film. But even just the helicopter sequences are pretty insane as well.
Well, and you've got that amazing helicopter stunt at the beginning where there's a stuntman dangling under a flying chopper as it's going over the sort of scenery, the countryside, and you know, really amazing scenery as well. Dangling, you know, the stuntman dangling under a chopper 12 years before Jackie Chan did it in Police Story 3. Now, it's not as good a sequence as Jackie's in Police Story 3, nor is it as elaborate, but, you know, it's pretty amazing to watch.
Mm. Like, even visually, like, the cinematography is pretty great here, and it doesn't surprise me that Vincent Motton, who is someone, again, who we've talked about a lot on this show, because he also shot Snapshot and Long Weekend and First, as well. And I'm a big fan of his work just based on everything we have seen from him throughout this mm-hmm. series so far. And I just think like he does a great job with the cinematography here. It just, the movie looks visually great. It really captures the New Zealand countryside extremely well. But at the end of the day, it really is like Donald Pleasance's show. And this is something you and I talked about, Marcy, whether this movie is secretly a stealth sequel to Wicked Fright in terms of his drunken performance in that film.
Yeah, I mean, did he just reprise his role of Doc from Wicked Fright? I mean, who's more drunk? I don't know.
I would say not. You know, he's definitely much more frightening, you know, much more viscerally intimidating in Wicked Fright. I don't hold that film in quite the regard that some do, but, you know, Pleasance is like genuinely unnerving in it. And I think you don't really get that in this. That's why I talked about, you know, the idea that with a few cuts, you could kind of make this a Disney kiddie adventure movie, because really he's just a sort of bumbling drunk in this, not a dangerous one.
Except for the scene.
He's drunk grandpa.
Well, except for the scene where he comes at Ken Wall with a bloody chainsaw. I don't know about you guys.
Fair.
That was terrifying.
Yeah, fair.
But overall, like, it's a pretty solid.
As I said, it would need a few cuts.
Well, exactly. And the score by Brian May. No, not that Brian May. which we say a lot
I
on the
like
show.
I always have to do that in my head whenever his name comes up on the credits. Oh, no, it's not that guy.
Indeed. And I still do that now, even though I know it's not him. But like, his score is really solid as well. It's got that good adventure vibe. But I will say this, like, I think, like, again, I think compared to his other screenplays, I think Everett DeRoach could have worked on it a little bit more. Even though, yeah, the three main characters played by Ken Wall, Donald Pleasance, and Leslie Ann Warren, like, I think the three of them together, since they kind of have very different characters, and I like how they sort of all gel together, because of course you got the drunken Donald Pleasance, you got the straight man in Ken Wall, and then of course you have Leslie Ann Warren, who is kind of the mixture of trying to be the sensible one and being annoying and stuff like that. So like that dynamic does actually work with the three of them there. And I enjoyed the camaraderie on screen. But at the same time, though, I do think that this film is a little too long than it needed to be, because it is an hour and 50 minutes. I feel like if they do cut out, say, maybe 10, 15 or 20 minutes, I feel like it probably would have been a better film.
Yeah, a movie like this is 87 minutes long. Is sort of the sweet spot for a movie like this, I think. But also, Leslie Ann Warren, I think, is fine, except that the performance is fine. The writing, Everett DeRoach definitely could have put a bit more into that character. I think for most of the film, she's, and this predates it, obviously, but she's kind of a Willie Scott figure. You know, she comes good at the end in the speedboat sequence, which is really cool, you know, despite obviously the terrible things that happened in making those sequences. You know, two or three stuntmen passed away during those jet boat sequences in accidents. That's too big a price for any film, to be clear. Yeah, that was jet boat coordinator Colin Robinson and drivers John Rilston and Bill Clark. Yeah, terrible. But, you know, it is amazing, though, watching how relatively small movies like this could at this time be such cool practical stunt shows, you know, in the pre-CG days. And both big and small movies now, in terms of stunt work, are so tediously artificial. You know, even when they've got people like hyping up actually doing stunts, you know, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning has that one amazing, you know, bike jump off the cliff, and that's real, and he did it, and the jerk on the parachute looks amazing. And then you get to the fight on top of the train, and you're just like, oh, they're in front of the green screen. It looks like shit, you know, and however good the choreography is. And you don't get that in these pre-CG days. Mm. It's just people, even when the karate in this is rubbish and one henchman is just doing some moves towards Ken Wall while he's shouting hi-ya and then basically falling over and down the hill. At least he's falling over and down the hill for real. And it looks really dangerous, you know. And even when the stuntman switch with Donald Pleasance is hilariously obvious, because Pleasance gets up about 10 feet from where the stuntman would have finished up in the same shot, at least it's actually happening. You saw something happen, you know. And I just don't get that sense anymore, you know. Mm. So I will enjoy any movie that brings that level of like dangerous dedication to making cool looking stunts, you know.
Actually, sort of looking up right now, apparently the US cut of this film is actually only 90 minutes long. So
yeah, so there you go. I told you, sweet spot.
definitely. And let me have a look. Before we get to our final thoughts on this film, do you guys realize that the opening footage that we see at the film, which kind of shows the origins of the Yankee Zephyr and how it during World War II, it was actually all shot for the film. It was...
I actually had no idea until after I saw it, and it's very well freaking done, because I thought it was real.
I thought so too, so I was actually legit surprised.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's well done, but am I the only one who like thought that was absolutely obvious?
Okay. Yeah, it might have just only been you, Sam.
It might have just been you, because I did not realize.
Indeed.
Okay.
But however, this film actually got a lot of trouble by the Australian Actors Group, because the reason why this film was shot in New Zealand rather than Australia, because the film's producer, Anthony I. Giannotti, who is a figure we're going to be talking about a lot on this show, the film was made in New Zealand instead of in Australia due to the Australian Actors Equity dispute. This was due to the refusal to permit four foreign actors, Ken Wall, Leslie Ann Warren, Donald Pleasance, and George Papar, to be cast as the four billed lead roles. As such, this meant there would not be one Australian actor in any of these parts. Anthony I. Giannotti took the production to New Zealand and would shoot his next couple of films in New Zealand, including one of the ones we're going to be talking about later on. And because of this, the film's original director, Richard Franklin, who had worked with Everett DeRoche quite a lot up to this point, decided to back out of filming since it was going to be shooting in New Zealand. And also, to kind of piggyback off that, David Hemmings, when he was brought in to direct, because he was originally just going to produce the film, but he ended up directing it, he was falling behind schedule. And someone who we love on this show, Marcy, Brian Trenchard-Smith, was actually brought in to possibly be a second unit director, but with the threat of possibly being replaced, David Hemmings boisted the Hemmings resolve, and he managed to complete the remainder of the film on time. Since the film went over budget and schedule, Donald Pleasance had to drop out of the role of Blair in John Carpenter's classic The Thing.
That is not a trade you wanted to have to make. This for The Thing. I mean, this isn't a terrible movie, but yikes.
I guess that could be a wrap on this conversation on Race for the Yankee Zephyr. Marcy, your final thoughts and rating for this film?
Yeah, so I give this one 3 drunken Donald Pleasances hanging out of a helicopter. Oh, geez, out of 5. Like, it's a watchable movie for the most part. There's a lot of fun bits. I just don't think it quite all comes together at the end. And again, the stunts really make it worth watching. Like, they're really well done. You can see it's the real people. And yeah, it wasn't terrible. It wasn't great, but somewhere in the middle.
And Sam, your final thoughts and rating for Race for the Yankee Zephyr.
I'll keep it brief because I feel like I've said it throughout. Great stunt show, inconsequential movie. 2.5.
I'm going to give this movie 3 Ken Walls unibrow out of 5. I mean, seriously, he's got a caterpillar, Marcy. I couldn't stop looking at it.
He kind of does. Yes.
But anyways, though, yeah, so 3 out of 5. Like I said, it's a pretty solid adventure film. Not as great as it could have been due to the script could have using a little bit more work in some areas and also being a little bit overlong than it needed to be. But it does have some pretty great set pieces, and also the performances are all pretty solid as well, particularly with one scenery-chewing performance from Donald Pleasance, who probably gives one of the great drunk performances in all of cinema. We'll move right along to our next film, which of course is the 1981 horror thriller Road Games.
Road Games. The truck driver plays games. The hitchhiker plays games.
Aren't you kind of young to be hitchhiking out here all by yourself?
Aren't you kind of old to be picking me up?
And a killer is playing the deadliest game of all.
Oh, he's just killed a girl.
Did he make love to her first?
I don't know. What's the difference?
It makes a lot of difference. I think in order to play the game properly, we have to know what he thinks of women.
Stacy Keach is Quid.
No, no, it's Quid. D is in death, the young girl, you cretin.
Jamie Lee Curtis is Hitch.
Attic and camera.
Now you're looking for a little adventure.
I could go to Disneyland for a little adventure. What I'm looking for is a little excitement.
Road Games. Across 1,600 miles of desert highway, they're playing games of violence and sudden death. Games.
It's my game.
Okay, Sherlock.
If someone doesn't stop soon, there won't be anyone left alive to play Road Games.
Which was directed by Richard Franklin, written by Everett DeRoche, based on a story by Richard Franklin and Everett DeRoche. This film stars Stacy Keach, Jamie Lee Curtis, Marion Edward, and Grant Page. And the plot summary from IMDb is, a laid-back American truck driver in South Australia suspects that the driver of a green van is killing young women along his route and plays a game of cat and mouse to catch him. Now, Marcy, your thoughts on Road Games.
Well, what happens when you mix Rear Window with Jewel? Well, it's Road Games. Richard Franklin was a well-known Alfred Hitchcock fan and later became friends with the man. And this certainly shined through, this certainly has shined through with his body of work, notably with helming Psycho 2, the follow-up to the Hitchcock classic, and Road Games apparently got him the gig, and it's not hard to see why. Road Games is an intense ride from start to finish. It's taking place on the open roads of Australia with lead Stacy Keach as Quid. Rather than observe through a telescope at his surroundings, Quid, as a truck driver, observes everything whilst on the road, and it's through this he stumbles upon a possible serial killer. Stacey Keach leads the film with such charisma and a likable character with Quid, and he's the type of character that it's easy to be around, and we're definitely sucked into this mystery along with him. Jamie Lee Curtis is second billed, but she has much less screen time. But she makes sure you take notice when she's on screen. I really liked her as Hitch. I enjoy this film a lot. It does kind of lose a little bit of steam in the third act, but once it gets going again, that weight pays off.
And Seb, your thoughts on Road Games?
So Marcy and I talked a little bit about this film on what is, by the time you're hearing this, still an upcoming episode of my Jennifer Jason Leigh podcast, which I co-present with my friend Jason Sean, called Fearless Pretender. We did an episode on that on The Hitcher, and we talked a little about Road Games for that. So this is actually the second time that I've watched it for a podcast in the last like 3 months.
Me too.
yeah. So I guess my first thought beyond that is, what the fuck? Did Everett de Roach just write every notable Australian film for a few years in the 70s and 80s?
Yes, he did.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, what a body of work. Like, the dude seemed to produce at sort of the rate of like an L. Ron Hubbard, who, you know, legendarily wrote thousands of stories and books because he was paid by the word, but actually write good, coherent stuff and not start a terrible religion. So, you know, that's fascinating in and of itself, because just the variety of stuff that de Roach put out into the Ausploitation world. Bouncing off some of what Marcy said, I don't think it's a coincidence that Jamie Lee Curtis' character is referred to throughout by Stacey Keach as Hitch. I mean, obviously it's short for Hitchhiker. But as Marcy notes, there's a heavy Rear Window influence here, especially in the opening sequence. And as well as that, there's the fact that, you know, Franklin clearly has a yen for the master. While Hitch is going through Quid's stuff when she's hiding in his truck from the cops when they pull him over, he's not meant to be picking up hitchhikers. We also see a Hitchcock Mystery Classics magazine among the other things that she's going through. So, you know, there's a lot of explicit nods, and I'm certain that him referring to her as Hitch is one. And this, of course, would have been shot probably either just before or just after Hitchcock passed away in 1980. So I suspect that it's a nod to a friend and a master. The observations that Quid is making on the road, I think, are interesting in that I feel that they're just a way of passing time initially. And I suspect that he's probably had similar suspicions briefly about other cars and vans that he's seen on the road, because we often, and obviously he's right this time, that there's something sinister with the green van that is, you know, around him the whole time. But I suspect that he's probably seen a blue car at some point and suspected similar sinister goings on, you know, because we see him endlessly talking to his dingo, talking out exposition and talking out his thoughts, which for me is a device that's functional, but a little clunky. I think some of it we could get through implication, because Keach is a good enough actor to communicate stuff without dialogue. And also it might have been fun to have him back on the radio more with like the operator that he talks to at the beginning. I also agree that the third act is a little drawn out, particularly the final sequence. The sort of slow pursuit after Hitch is taken in the green van is also a little drawn out. There's a sequence where he thinks he spots the green van, but it kind of comes to nothing. That doesn't really do very much in the grand scheme of things. And this is, it's not super long, but it's about 100 minutes. And I feel like you could pare it down a little bit more. I think exploitation films going over 90 minutes is often a little indulgent. And there are a few longers here.
I've seen Road Games quite a number of times over the years. I'm just going to say it right now. I do absolutely love this film. This is definitely Richard Franklin firing all cylinders with his influence from Hitchcock. Since he was basically a protege of the man, you could really sense that throughout this film. But visually, and again, Vincent Modden also shot this film as well. And again, also music by Brian May. No, not that Brian May, as well. So we're getting a lot of familiar names throughout this series, but I think how Richard Franklin stages specific scenes and shots is just amazing in this film. Like, there are so many moments throughout it that even if it's just done subtly, it's very, very creepy. Like, of course, like, this film has the famous shot where you have a nude hitchhiker on the bed strumming a guitar, and you see Grant Page, the very awesome Grant Page, like coming out
of
the
bathroom. He's been discussed many times on this podcast.
Indeed. Coming out of the bathroom and it's just like, it's like a very stylized shot. It shot alone is just amazing. And there's so many other ones as well that's just so creepy. Like, I also love the moment, and this actually gave me chills, where you have Jamie Lee Curtis's character of Hitch going, when her and Quid parked out in that little abandoned town, which is actually a real place because I looked it up as well. And also the story that Quid talks about is actually events that actually did happen there. Like, when Hitch goes up on the hill and looks over and sees the green van, I like that. Yeah, it's all a dark to see there, but whenever the lightning strikes, you see Biff or Jones, as the character is called, like, just there in the van staring back at her. And it's such a creepy shot. Also, like, I think there is something to say, like, what you were saying before, Sam, when you said, like, this is something with him kind of figuring out or having suspicions about Smith or Jones on the road. You kind of get a sense of that very early on as he's driving around. He looks at all the side characters in their automobiles as they're driving along, and he comes up with backstories or names, or he tries to figure out who they are. And I love the fact that even with one of the characters, Frida, played by Marion Edward, like, he comes up with figures like, oh, she's a nagging wife, her husband's most likely an accountant. Definitely an accountant. And then we've kind of, and I also love the attention to detail. If you listen to the radio, he is actually this character that this accountant that meat market workers are striking against. So it's kind of cool that stuff is in the background to kind of add more to the story. Also, just the how many great set pieces are in this film. But I will say one of the things I love most about this film is Stacey Keach as Quid. Like, I can definitely see your point, Sam, about it can be a little clunky when Quid is talking to Boswell and he's talking out loud of everything he's thinking. But I think Stacey Keach is such a charismatic actor, and he makes you immediately fall in love with Quid that you just don't mind that. Like, I could sit there and listen to Quid talk for hours on the road.
Yeah. I do agree that you know, that interaction he has with, like, the operator and stuff, like, that is really good. And I feel like we could have had a bit more of that as well. But as you said, like, you could just listen to him talk about absolutely nothing and be engaged because he's got that charisma that you just kind of pay attention to him.
Indeed. And
yeah, I mean, I don't disagree. Sorry.
No, you go ahead, Sam.
No, I was saying, I don't disagree with any of what you guys are saying there. The dialogue is perfectly well written. Keach delivers it brilliantly. I just think you know, you could have found more variety of ways to integrate it into the film than just talking at the dingo or just talking out loud to nobody. You know, I think that there's a greater variety that you could have worked with there. Just to spin off some of what both of you were saying, Richard Franklin obviously directs the hell out of this. That shot that you were mentioning with Jamie Lee Curtis looking over the cliff edge is fantastic. And the shot of the hitchhiker, I think it's hard to say is iconic. I don't know that this film is particularly well known enough for that to be true, but probably should be. It's just a great image, really conveys a lot of menace as well. The killer approaching from behind like that. It's really a great way in which to start the film. It makes it absolutely unnerving for the rest of the film, because you know ahead of time, and this is another Hitchcock trick, that Quid is correct. Tell the audience more than you tell the characters. To bounce off what Marcy was saying, I always forget how little Jamie Lee Curtis is in this. I mean, she's got a sort of big part in the second act and isn't really in much of the rest of it. I think she's great here. You really understand why Stacey Keach wants to save her. You know, not just because it's the basic right thing to do, but also because there's a good dynamic between them. And I like the fact that though there's definitely a attraction on both sides, it never becomes sexual. You know, Keach is always clear that, you know, I'm too old for you, sort of thing. And, you know, I think it's stronger for that. As I was saying, I think there's a few longueurs about it. I would be fine dropping the I Spy scene, for instance. it has a really good payoff, but it really takes the long way around getting to it. The other scene that I love, though, and the other scene that I think is really brilliant, brilliantly directed, just before what I think is a slightly overlong final chase, the weigh-in sequence is really, really great. There's a sense of urgency to that and Quid triggering the weigh-in guy's suspicion about why he doesn't want to come in for a drink. And the rising tension, both in Quid as a character and in you as an audience member, I think is really, really strong. I might be my favorite scene in the film, that and maybe the bathroom scene, which also has that kind of tension. Yeah, Franklin, as I say, really directs the hell out of this.
And it's not a surprise, like, this was the film that got him the job to direct Psycho 2.
Like, you cannot argue with that whatsoever. And for those of us who have seen Psycho 2, it is absolutely excellent.
Psycho 2 is a film that has absolutely no right to be as good as it is. I think it's more than Franklin's direction. I think the screenplay is outstanding and really gives like new depth to Norman Bates. It brings different ideas out of that character. And Perkins is spectacular in it. But Richard Franklin really does a great job with it in the, and I think more so even than what he does here, is he brings both a Hitchcock classicism to it, but also pure 80s slasher. It's really just a great film, I think, on par with the original for me.
No, 100%, yeah.
Speaking of the bathroom scene, Marcy, do you recognize who Sneezy Ryder is?
I actually have no idea.
Marcy, what if I told you Sneezy Ryder is Patrick?
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Well, there Patrick, you go. There's a little Patrick cameo.
Yes. Robert Thompson, who played Patrick, played Sneezy Ryder in this movie.
Interesting. There was something I did want to bring up, and I'm sure we'll never answer it. How did Stacey Keach manage to ride that motorbike straight into the wall? Well, did he do it on purpose? Was it in the script? Was he meant to ride off?
To be fair, Marcy,
I love that scene, I have to say, though.
I mean, it is a very funny scene, but to be fair, though, he's probably more of a truck driver than a bike rider. So,
I mean, that is fair.
And he probably just fucked up when he was trying to go around a corner, because believe me, that has happened to me. Maybe not that extent, but very similar things have happened to me as somebody who has never really ridden a motorbike before.
Yeah, it's just, it's a very, like, realistic scene, you know. It's, it's, for me, it's one of the memorable moments in the movie.
Yep, definitely. And some trivia on the movie. With a budget of 1.75 billion Australian dollars, Road Games was at the time the most expensive Australian film ever made.
I thought you were going to say it was the most Australian movie ever made for a second. Mean,
a film with two American actors in the lead roles definitely makes it the most Australian film ever made.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm kind of sensing a theme on tonight's episode with some of the trivia. It seems like a lot of Australian filmmakers and actors were not happy with foreign filmmakers or actors coming to work.
It seemed that...
And now those bastards are all over Hollywood. I mean, they're just such hypocrites.
It was definitely sort of during this era once, you know, I think people were more interested in Australian cinema, that this was when this happened a bit more often, whereas kind of when you go back to the early 70s, it wasn't that common.
Yeah, exactly. Because originally Lisa Pierce was originally cast as Hitch, but AVCO Embassy Pictures, who had contributed half the budget to the film's production, pushed for an American actress to play the part. And then that's how Richard Franklin cast Jamie Lee Curtis in the role, because he asked her friend John Carpenter to get in touch with him, and so that happened. And because of that, the Actors' Equity of Australia actually almost nixed the entire production altogether. However, though, Jamie Lee Curtis has said that she felt a certain amount of hostility and prejudice while working on the set as one of the two token Americans on the production. And even one of the crew members approached her and asked, "What is it like putting Australians out of work?"
Yeah, so, and I think she goes into that in the not quite, what was it? It's not quite Hollywood doco from many years ago now.
yep, definitely. And but you're right, though. I think it wasn't too bad of a problem in the 70s, because we saw a lot of foreign actors and filmmakers come into Australia to make projects or be a part of them. But I think around this time, I guess, like, the tides were kind of changing in the Australian film industry, because the 70s was when Australian films kind of started peaking with the mixture of exploitation and the new wave movement. And I guess by this time, people wanted more Australian filmmakers to work on these films. And as Sam eloquently put it before, now Australia's taking over Hollywood. We it cannot be stopped. It's just about to happen. But, Mussy, your final thoughts and rating for Road Games.
Yeah, so I give this one 4.5 heads are falling into buckets out of 5. It is a very weird way to end the film, and I know that Richard Franklin wasn't a fan of that aspect. But, you know, as with everything we've said, I just think this is a great film. It's very watchable. It's really enjoyable, and it gets very intense at times. And I am quite a fan of the work that Richard Franklin has done. So absolutely. If you haven't seen it, go check it out.
And Sam, your final thoughts and rating for Road Games.
I feel like I've said it all here. I think there's, I don't disagree with anything Marcy said there. I think it's really strong, really ratchets tension well. I think my only criticism might be that I think it could turn that tension up even a little more by trimming back some of its slightly more indulgent moments. Like I said, the I Spy scene comes very readily to mind. But, you know, the performances are terrific. And Franklin obviously does a fantastic job directing it. It's a really strong, I would say, thriller more than horror movie. 3.5 for me of 5.
I'm going to give this 4.5. Boswell is the goodest boy out of 5. Because Bosworth steals the whole movie, and I'm surprised you didn't bring him up at all in your...
I know. I actually did not. But yes, very good boy.
Yes, but I do love this film. Like, I do agree it does start to kind of be a bit unfocused once it gets towards the end. But you know, as I was looking at trivia before, apparently there is a pretty good reason why that is, because they just basically rushed that entire ending, so hence why it kind of turned out the way it did. But other than that, though, like everything else, I do absolutely love. I think this is a great filmmaker's showcase for Richard Franklin. But that being said, I think Everett DeRoach's screenplay is pretty top-notch. The performances from both Stacy Keach and Jamie Lee Curtis are fantastic, and they have great chemistry together. And there's just so many great sequences and shots throughout this film that I just absolutely loved. And I also love the fact that this film even takes the time to even though the score of the film is great, it does actually not use the score at all in some of the film's more intense sequences, which I do appreciate. So now we'll go on to our fifth and final film for this episode of the show. And that, of course, is the 1981 slasher film Dead Kids, or as is also known as Strange Behavior.
Here, in the peaceful Midwestern town of Galesburg, nothing much ever happens.
Morning, Mr. McNally.
The kids go to an ordinary college.
However, this is no ordinary professor. Dead.
And they help science with a few harmless experiments.
2 sessions, 2 days, $100 a day.
He always welcome the chance for new blood.
He killed little rabbits back there.
I tell you, there was different parts of different bodies in different rooms. One nurse, you couldn't find all the parts. That'll make up kind of a composite of bits and pieces missing from all the other bodies.
John, do you want me to call Donovan? Do you want me to call the state police? Do you want me to call anybody?
Pete, stop the car. Just pull over.
I'm going to find out who did this, I swear to God.
With this little pill, the world will be yours for the next few days.
A little high. Am I supposed to feel a little high?
What did they do to you up there?
What are those needles for? What are you sticking me with?
She said it was like she was drowning.
We invite you to come with us on a terrifying experiment.
Help! Somebody! Help!
It started all over again.
An experiment with dead kids.
But very strange looking people at this party.
I'm not wearing any underwear.
Dead kids. They'll scare the living daylights out of you.
And this film was directed by Michael Laughlin, written by Bill Condon, yes, that future Oscar-winning director Bill Condon, and Michael Laughlin. And this film stars Michael Murphy, Louise Fletcher, Dan Shaw, Fiona Lewis, Arthur Dingham, Dae Young, and Mark McClure. And the plot summary for this one, which I'm reading off IMDb, is a scientist is experimenting with teenagers and turning them into murderers. Now, Marcy, I know that Dead Kids is a first-time watch for you. Tell us your thoughts on this film.
This was an unexpected surprise. I was not sure what to expect with this one, but I do admit the title Dead Kids was intriguing. It may be somewhat misleading, as the dead kids might be like three teenagers or so. Strange Behavior is a better title with what actually happens in the film, because there is strange behavior. Teenage boys start getting murdered in a small town. There's no real suspects, but there seems to be a clinic who's recruiting teenagers, and they could be involved. And of course they are involved, with mind control to do evil, because of course it's for evil. Why else do you need mind control? I really like the tone of the film and the very creepy atmosphere. There are certainly some moments that are a little bit unnerving. The standout, though, for me was Fiona Lewis as Gwen Parkinson. She oozes charisma and commands the screen whenever she's on. The rest of the cast just kind of pales in comparison to what she does. I think the final part of the film is perhaps the strongest part, and it even threw a twist in there I didn't see coming. I quite liked this strange film.
And Seb, your thoughts on Dead Kids?
Again, initially, I sort of question whether it's my place or not to how much of a degree this is really an Ozploitation film, in that it's, which Marcy didn't mention, set entirely in the US with an American cast doing American accents. And, you know, it's outwardly a very American film. I'm not sure if it was shot in Australia. Maybe you guys know.
It was shot in New Zealand, but it was an Australian co-production.
Right. So, I mean, it has that, but otherwise it just, in feel, in casting and all of that, it's a very American film and falls right into the slasher craze as well, which, you know, was an international thing, but, you know, driven by American films. I will say I'm really glad this has a more innocuous alternate title, because I didn't have a copy of this. And when we're doing our research for these episodes, I don't know that I really want to be Googling Watch Dead Kids. It took me a while to find this. There's a terrible jumpy copy on the Internet Archive, but I found one on YouTube, which was a VHS rip. Not ideal, but also kind of appropriate for me, because this was on the Section 3 video nasties list in the UK when that whole panic was going on in the early 80s. Now, that Section 3 means that it was never actually prosecuted, but it was withdrawn. And to my knowledge, there's still not an uncut UK release. The last version that I know of, which was a 2008 DVD release, I believe, as Strange Behavior, is still cut for imitable techniques when one of the characters towards the end of the film cuts his wrists vertically. As well as that, it probably got on the DPP's radar for eye trauma, which is something that they really didn't like and went after repeatedly, notably in Lucio Fulci films and especially Zombie Flesh Eaters. So to spin off again what Marcy was saying, I agree. There's a really nice creepy atmosphere throughout. I really like the opening sequence, which has a kid coming downstairs only to get sort of stabbed in silhouette by, I think it's his older brother. And it has some really interesting visuals as well. There's a costume party early in the film, which has a lot of references. All of the characters are, teenage characters are dressed up as characters from TV shows. So you've got a few that are sort of vaguely Flintstones. You've got a very specific genie from I Dream of Genie. And in that sequence, you've got the killer wearing a mask that some people may not recognize, but it's actually Tor Johnson from Plan 9 from Outer Space, which, you know, is a fun reference if you're a movie nerd, and particularly a bad movie nerd, which, you know, I am. Yeah, there's a lot of fun to be had here. I also agree about Fiona Lewis. There are some uneven performances here, but Fiona Lewis is great. She has a Rachel from Blade Runner look a year before Blade Runner. And a sort of severe attitude that, if she weren't so obviously evil, is would be kind of a little sexy. Or maybe it's still a little sexy, I'm not judging. plays like a setup for porn, I've been told.
Oh, it really does, yeah.
Okay, cool. But there's a relish to that performance that we just don't get anywhere else in the film. The leads are quite bland otherwise, particularly Dan Shaw, who is the lead among the teens, who, if you recognize him, is Bill and Ted's Billy the Kid.
Mm-hmm.
But here he's a bit of a blank slate, and somewhat before the film really calls for him to be. But there's some good stuff going on here, and we'll get into the final confrontation a bit later, I guess. But yeah.
Indeed.
Well, this was my second time watching the film. I believe I watched this as part of a marathon. I believe Marcy, the Fox Classics channel had on Foxtel back in the day. Because they did like an Ozploitation Day where they had this film, The Survivor, Turkey Shoot, Patrick, and I can't remember what the other film was. But yeah, and I will admit, out of those five I watched, Dead Kids was my least favorite. I just found it like it just didn't work for me as a whole. So watching this again, like possibly, I would say about probably 13 years since I'd last seen it. I wasn't sure what to expect from this film, how I would feel about it. But I gotta say, it definitely is a mixed bag of a film. Like, there are things about it that don't work, there are things about it that do work, but it is a very interesting little slasher, and that has a very unique story and a lot of weirdness throughout it. And also, it's not afraid to kind of get surprisingly dark and vicious at parts.
Oh,
Like some
yeah.
of the death scenes in this film, I will admit I was actually kind of taken aback by, because on how they were presented in the film. And also, like, where it goes with its story, it kind of catches you off guard, because when you see the killer in that in the Tor Johnson mask trying to attack and kill people, and then you realize it's Jimmy Olsen under the mask, I'm like, okay. Then I'm thinking, oh, well, that's early in the film to show us who the killer is, but then we realize no, he's one of many, but he only did that due to some experiments that kind of put him into that situation, and he wasn't even aware that he even did it. So there's an interesting sci-fi element to the story, and from there it just gets more and more weirder. Totally, the film is a little jarring, and yeah, some of the performances are kind of a mixed bag, but yeah, it's I gotta give this film credit for just having this really weird, surreal atmosphere throughout it. Like, you get it from the very beginning right until the very last frame.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things is how the sort of science experimentation area, like it's the set of, I guess, what the building would be, it's so bizarre, and it kind of messes with your head a little bit. And I kind of like that they made it look very different, almost kind of futuristic for the early 80s. But it's yeah, it's kind of almost unnerving in a way, because like weird laboratory clinic thingies, they have to give off that
Yeah,
kind of
it's got a
unnerving
similar
thing.
sort of sterility to what Fiona Lewis is doing with some of her performance, which I think works really nicely. And I think the set design in that section is really, really good. There's a lot going on, actually, ultimately. I may even end up bumping my grade up on a rewatch. The only thing I think is a bit weak, as I said, is some of the performances, which are a little flat. And there's a big info dump just before we get into the last, 15 minutes, which are going to form the final confrontation. Louise Fletcher has to give this big info dump, which I feel like could have been, more gradually seeded throughout. And been a bit more graceful. But what it does do is set up some more interesting stakes than you would think for the final confrontation, and then allow it to have a clever little twist, actually, that as Marcy said, I didn't see that coming. Maybe I'm dumb, but there's some, as I said, some interesting ideas happening here. And I'm usually okay with giving spoilers on this show, because a lot of people have seen the films that we're talking about, and we can always say spoiler warning, but I genuinely don't want to give this one away. I think if you haven't seen the film, you should be able to go in entirely cold on that twist in the end.
Definitely, definitely. But it's just a very interesting film. And I think also the fact that Tangerine Dream did the score for this film as well
Yeah.
really adds to the eerie, surreal vibe to it.
Definitely, definitely.
Always a good sign.
And also, I'd like looking up trivia because I do have it here in our notes. Arthur Dingham, who plays the evil scientist at the center of the film, Dr. Lesage, Klaus Kinski was originally offered the role, but he turned it down. And I can only imagine what Klaus Kinski would have been like in this movie.
I mean, I have no idea.
And also, Bill Condon, yes, that Bill Condon, who co-wrote this film, actually, he played the teenager who got killed at the very beginning of the film, which I didn't realize until I was doing research on this film. And
Yeah, I didn't know that either. I must
find out if he's actually appeared in anything else and then file that away for my next game of Cinephile.
Yes, exactly. Also, this was the first horror film to be shot in New Zealand. And as we would know, New Zealand will be at a later date become like a treasure trove of horror films in the future. So it's kind of cool that this was
Yes.
like the very, even though this was a co-production with Australia and the US, the fact that this kind of kickstarted New Zealand's own horror movement. And finally, this film, actually, the film's co-writer and director, Michael Lachlan, actually intended Dead Kids or Strange Behavior, as it's also known as the first installment of a trilogy of horror films with the word strange in the title. And he actually did make a follow-up called Strange Invaders, which I have seen, and most of the cast actually came back for that one. Unfortunately, he never got around to making the third installment, and nobody knows what that third installment was going to be. So it's kind of interesting, like he made, well, I guess two films in a trilogy that, other than kind of a standalone stories, just with the word strange in the title. Yes. But
Yes.
anyway, yes. But anyways, though, Marcy, your final thoughts and rating for Dead Kids.
Yeah, I give this rating 3.5 injections to the eye out of 5. I quite enjoyed this film, and as I said, I wasn't really sure what to expect, and it was a rather pleasant surprise. There's certainly a lot going on, and while it does have some weaker parts, I think overall it's quite an interesting and watchable film. So yeah, another one I would recommend people check out. And I didn't mention earlier, but we'll mention now, just in a bit of a conclusion, some of the films do have releases from Umbrella. And some of the films, and again, some of the films that we've covered for the show can be found on Umbrella's new streaming service, Broly. So, yeah, if you have a bit of trouble finding the films and you're located in Australia, things like Umbrella and Broly can help you out when, I guess, archive.org isn't doing the best job, but also somehow Tubi seems to end up with a bit of Ozploitation on there as well.
Indeed, and we should also mention that Broly are also a free streaming service as well.
Yes, much like Tubi, it is for free.
Indeed, and also Dead Kids itself actually has a pretty sweet collector's edition Blu-ray here in Australia that also includes the soundtrack. And also, when I was looking at the special features that after I watched it, it also includes a feature-length fan-made sequel, which I was very surprised about. So I'll have to watch that at a later point. But Sam, your final thoughts and rating for Dead Kids?
Yeah, more than the others that we've talked about today, I think talking this one out and thinking it through, even with my notes and just considering it as we were talking it through, I can see my grade going up for this on a second watch. If you can forgive it some fairly ropey performances, then there's a lot to enjoy here from some really gnarly shit in the kills. The bathroom kill is particularly nasty. To some genuinely interesting twists and turns in the plot. So Yeah, I'm going to go 3 out of 5, but I can see that going up.
Yeah, I think for my rating, I'm giving it 3 out of 5 as well. It does have its flaws, and we've talked about them through this section of the episode, but it does have a lot of qualities that make it really stand out compared to other, not just exploitation films, but even slasher films at the time, because it has such a weird vibe throughout it. And also having a sort of a sci-fi element to it definitely adds to the proceedings as well. But, and also it's just very unique as a film. And the fact that it's a US, Australian, New Zealand co-production that's shot in New Zealand with an entire cast of Americans that's set in America, it has that kind of weird disconnect with, like, having an American director and writers, an Australian producer, like having all three of these countries mashed together for this one film, it kind of gives the film such a weird but interesting feel that makes it quite unique. So yeah, I'd say it's definitely worth checking out, and even picking up the Blu-ray as well from Umbrella. Yes, that is the end for this long-awaited new episode of the Ozploidcast, the return episode of the show. Thank you, Marcy, for always being a very awesome and very Aussie co-host, as per usual.
I try and do my best, and you're welcome.
And Sam, thanks for coming back on the show again to talk some Ozploitation cinema with us.
Always a pleasure, guys. Always a pleasure, except when I have to watch Center Spread, but you know, there you go.
Well, if you ever come back, I'm going to find you a movie that's even worse than that one for you.
I'm sure you'll try. But no, it would be great to come back. There's a few titles I'm actually going to potentially mention to you after we get off this record and say, I want to be on for that one, so...
Definitely. And Marcy, where can people find this on the internet this week?
Yeah, if you want to check out the Ozploitcast, we are on supermarcy.com as part of the Super Network. And you can go on your podcast players such as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all of those. You can just type in the Ozploitcast and we should be coming right up, and you can subscribe and like and all that cool stuff if you aren't already. So that would be great. And of course, in the show notes, you will find all the links to that as well as the Super Network socials. And me personally, I'm available at Super Marcy on most of the socials, and super_Marcy on the Letterboxd. And I do keep a list of the Ozploit films as we do the podcast. I update them so you can check out all my ratings and stuff for the films as well.
Awesome. And Sam, where can people find you on the internet this week? And also, where can people hear your podcast, Fearless Pretender?
Yeah, as I said, Fearless Pretender is a podcast about the great character actress Jennifer Jason Leigh, my favorite actress. And we put out episodes pretty much every month. We're getting back on a monthly schedule starting in January, when we'll have our next episode out, which will be the first in a series of special episodes, occasional special episodes on unmade Jennifer Jason Leigh films, so films that she was almost in. And for that episode, we're talking about films including Pretty Woman, which she was certainly she auditioned for. You can find that on Spotify at Fearless Pretender. We're on several podcast players. You know, we're around, so just Google Fearless Pretender podcast. You can find me. I have drastically reduced my social media following recently because I have stopped interacting over at Twitter because fuck that place. And I am now on Blue Sky as 24FPS UK. And I am also under that name at and I am also under that tag at Letterboxd. So you can follow my viewing and various list-making things over there. Yeah, and hopefully also in the new year, we will be returning, myself and my friend Tim, with new episodes of our Ethan Hawke filmography podcast, Hawke Talk. So there's that to look forward to as well. Of course, we've also got Marcy coming up on Fearless Pretender in February for The Hitcher.
Yes.
So look forward to that. Yeah.
Thank you very much for that invitation as well. And yes, people, check out those podcasts and check out Sam on Blue Sky and Letterboxd. Beat.
Well, if people want to find me out there on the internet, you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/BeadJamine. You can also find me on Blue Sky under BeadJamine. Also, you can find me on Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/BeadJamine. And of course, you can find all my work over at supermarcy.com and as well as you can hear my solo podcast, Bead vs. the Living Dead, which is, of course, if you don't know, is my podcast on all the different variations of Night of the Living Dead that have been released. And as well as my other show that I co-host with Stephen T. Boltz, Bead and Steve versus Camp Crystal Lake, which is our podcast on the entire Friday the 13th franchise. And you can listen to both those shows via the Bead vs. the Living Dead podcast feed on all podcast streamers everywhere. So yeah, that is an end for this long-awaited 12th episode of the Ozploid cast. And keep a lookout for episode 13 in January, which we will be discussing the films Pacific Banana, The Survivor, Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior, Ladies Stay Dead, and Crosstalk. So stay tuned for that one, everyone, next month, and we'll see you all then. See you, everyone. Bye.
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 Super Network is proudly sponsored by Surfshark VPN. Why would you have a VPN in this day and age? Well, a lot of people are quite concerned about tracking and their online privacy, and using a VPN ensures that you are safe and secure online. Surfshark VPN provides a lot of extra added layers of security, as well as ad blocker and a kill switch if your information is ever compromised. A great bonus feature with having Surfshark is something is not available on your streaming service in your country. You just pop on that Surfshark VPN and you can probably find so much more streaming in different countries. If you want to find something like Masters of Horror, it is available on Tubi, so just select the correct country and you'll be able to watch such a great and fantastic show. Surfshark VPN is one of the most reliable and cheapest of the VPNs out there, with up to 81% off offer when you subscribe for 24 months. Please use the link surfshark.deals/supernetwork to take advantage of this amazing deal. You can also find the link in the show notes. Thank you, Surfshark. Surfy shark do 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 do. Surfy shark do 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 do. And now back to the show.